You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. It looks like there's more water and ice on the moon than we thought. Coming up, we'll talk about what we know about it, what we don't, and how the new findings may affect NASA's plans to explore the lunar surface. Now, an executive order signed by President Trump last week could take away job protections from tens of thousands of workers in the federal civil service. Those workers, many of them the nonpartisan researchers and policy experts at federal agencies that help advise political appointees, could be fired much easier and lose due process and union rights. The Trump administration says the move would make federal workers more accountable to the public, but critics say it opens the door to firing experts and hiring their replacements based on political loyalty. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Does doing away with these civil service protections concern you? Do you generally trust that federal agencies are staffed by people doing their job well, regardless of who the president is? If you or someone you know has worked in that civil service, federally or in Wisconsin, what do you think about this move? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Don Kettle is a professor of public policy and management at the Lyndon Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas Austin, formerly a professor at UW-Madison. Don, welcome back.
Rob, it is good to be with you this afternoon.
Can you spell out a little more of what this executive order from the president could change?
Sure. This might sound awfully arcane, but it's really fundamentally important. What it really does in a nutshell is to take 140 years worth of both tradition and policy that holds that we ought to hire federal employees and promote them on the basis of merit, not on political favoritism. That is, we would wipe out the spoil system and focus on merit, and instead to replace that with a system that would involve any federal employee who's involved in making policy or shaping policy or advising policy or researching policy into a new schedule where they could be dismissed at will. What that really means is that creates a system of political favoritism to replace that system of merit, and the implications for federal service are enormous.
What does this mean for dismissing current federal civil service employees if this goes through and these changes are made, and for hiring new ones?
Well, it would not apply to all federal employees, only employees who are involved in some kind of policy role. However, since so much of the federal workforce is involved in shaping policy, then it would involve perhaps tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of employees, so that the sweep could be enormous. And what it would mean is that if you're in a job that is classified as part of this new schedule, it's called Schedule F, then both your hiring and the possibility of promotions and ultimately dismissals would all be shaped by the decisions of your supervisors about whether or not you are providing the kind of advice that they want and the kind of advice that they want to keep. There'd be no protections for merit, no protections for due process, no protections for discrimination on issues of race or equality as things are sitting now. And so that the opportunity for reshaping the federal workforce is enormous there. And it would make employees at will and therefore subject to dismissal for virtually any reason whatsoever without any rights of appeal. But also change the odds of being able to be hired, because in all likelihood, it would create a kind of political screen for employees before, in fact, they are hired in the federal workforce.
Can you talk about the bad old days? You say this goes back about 140 years. I think this is connected to the assassination of President James Garfield by a job seeker who didn't get one of these spoils, patronage type jobs. What were things like before the federal government had this civil service system in place?
Back in that part of the 19th century, the idea was that literally, as we've heard over and over again, to the victor belongs the spoils. That means whoever wins had the opportunity to be able to put thousands and thousands of their friends in federal positions. But what that meant was that instead of having experts who were in federal service and were in charge of figuring out the best way to do particular jobs, people were hired based not on what they knew, but on who they knew. And that meant every time that there was a change of administration, thousands of people would be swept out. Thousands of new people would come in. It was a miserable time for top officials because people would literally line up outside their houses. There's stories about some federal officials, cabinet officials in particular, who would be sitting there even trying to have breakfast and find people bursting through their doors demanding jobs. And in the case of President Garfield, there was someone who was convinced in a deranged kind of way that he was responsible for getting Garfield elected to the presidency. thought he deserved one of the very best administrative policy jobs, maybe even ambassadorship in Europe somewhere, didn't get it, got passed over, and took his revenge out on the president. That was really the last straw of something that had been going on for a long time and building up, because the government was simply losing the capacity to be able to manage a government. It was getting more and more complicated in doing everything from trying to find ways of managing the trusts of large companies to the safety of food. So we went to a system of trying to hire people based on merit and moving away from that spoil system that actually cost President Garfield his life.
Talking to Don Kettle from the University of Texas Austin about changes to the civil service system. An executive order signed by the president starts a process to make that change. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to a caller, Charlie, with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I guess my first comment would be, if Trump signs an executive order, I think President Biden's probably going to change that executive order once he gets elected. So this is only going to be a viable for a couple weeks. The other question that I had is, it does seem, though, that the people that would politically be motivated into the civil service might have an agenda that's different from the people who are elected. And specifically, I mean, if someone wants to make government smaller, why would people part of the workforce in the government be promoting or be loyal to people who are trying to eliminate their jobs, which sets up leaking and what have you? Thanks,
Charlie,
so
thanks a lot for the call. One big assumption there, Charlie's first point, a Biden win, which we'll see, maybe not. But what do you think, Don, of what he said about that? He sees a kind of a built-in conflict of interest, maybe, with that longtime civil service member, if there's a president who is working against their objectives, maybe against their livelihood.
Well, and there's always a risk of that. And that's a risk that we take in exchange for building up expertise of people who know how to do the job. And the basic idea is this, which has worked pretty well for a long time. If the president wants to do something, if a cabinet officer has some policy ideas, then the best way to be able to promote it is to have the expertise to be able to pull it off and to know in particular what the downside might be of going down that policy so that you have a chance to be able to correct it before it becomes a big and insurmountable problem. Suppose, for example, that you had the idea of launching, say, a major new healthcare system and you're going to do it with a website. It'd be nice to have people, and this is a story of the Obamacare website, that you had people who had the competence to be able to put it together, which in fact didn't happen and caused an enormous embarrassment for the administration. If you're going to launch an effort to try to take out a foreign terrorist, then you'd like to know, how many helicopters do you need? How many troops do you need? Should you take a dog along as a way to try to provide some extra help and care? How many refueling tankers do you need? That was the story about taking out Obama. And those are all questions that rely on the expertise. Osama bin Laden. And that was a matter that required the kind of expertise that only would come with people who had been in the business for a very long time. So in both cases, the real issue is that, yes, to be sure, there's a matter of political loyalty, but so much of what a president wants to do requires the expertise of individual employers who have been there for a long time, who are in a position to be able to help make things happen or not.
We're talking to Don Kettle. Thanks for the call, Charlie. Don's professor of public policy and management at the University of Texas Austin, looking at an executive order from President Trump that would make it easier to fire federal civil service workers and change hiring policies, too. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this move from the Trump administration? Do you worry about the potential of policy advisors and others to be hired just on the basis of political loyalty as opposed to their qualifications for the job? Do you have questions about how all this stuff works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Don Kettle, professor of public policy and management at the University of Texas Austin's LBJ School of Public Affairs, looking at an order from President Trump that could take job protections away from thousands of federal civil servants. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to our callers. Cynthia is with us in Menominee. Cynthia, hi.
Hi. I'm a retired state civil service employee, and Wisconsin has done away with the civil service exams, saying we're going to go to resume-based. Well, we always were resume-based, but civil service exams meant you could find people with the communication skills, the thought process. It's a beginning. This nepotism is just crazy. We see what happened with the Postmaster General. Somebody incompetent, just during this election right now, he's never worked in the post office. It's cronyism. It doesn't work.
Cynthia, thanks a lot for the call. Don, Cynthia is seeing the risk of cronyism going up with these kind of changes.
Right, and there's no doubt that risk is there. Let's face it, the spoil system is great for bringing friends in, and it's great for providing jobs to people who are supporters, and it's also great for finding ways of increasing loyalty, but it's not so good at finding ways of reinforcing the kind of competence that you need. To what degree, for example, should we rely on either political loyalty on the one side or technical competence on the other when it comes to figuring out whether or not a particular vaccine for COVID is going to work, or how best to distribute it? And that's where this basic issue comes down. And that's the risk of moving, in my mind, from a system that is really based on competence to one that's based on political favoritism.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to another caller. Mike joins us next in Racine. Mike, hello.
Hey, how you doing? I'd like to say surprise, surprise. I think since Donald Trump has been in office, every one of his, the head of his cabinets have been the antithesis of what that cabinet position is supposed to do, whether you take energy, education, especially the climate change or the environment. Thank God those people, like you're talking about, have been in there to sort of stop some of it, but I think it will be a disaster if you have the working people, like you said, he's trying to get rid of to be in those positions, whether it's Betty, whoever headed education, she was anti-education, the head of climate change, he's probably against climate change. So anyway, I think it's a terrible idea.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. And that is also a reminder, Don, that we have kind of a hybrid system. There are political appointees in each agency. There's cabinet appointees who have to get approved, of course, by the Senate. We have some people based on their politics and their loyalty along with the civil servants we're talking about.
Well, that's right. And we've had for a very long time political appointees who sit at the top, and then we have a career bureaucracy underneath. It's always, of course, been a source of political friction, but it's been a deal that we made to try to balance political responsiveness on the one side with technical expertise on the other. The problem with this is that it really upsets that arrangement that we've had, and it's really worked pretty well for a very long time, because it would vastly increase the number of what amounts to political appointees. And if you were to talk to experts in the field, you'd be very hard pressed to find anybody who argues that what we really need are fewer experts and more political loyalists in charge of the key decisions in so many federal agencies.
Now, the president, thanks a lot for that call. The president and some of his supporters have made no secret. They don't like a lot of these positions. These people who've had these jobs, they refer to it as the deep state, see them as conspiring against the president's agenda. How do you answer those concerns from the president and his supporters?
Well, there's no doubt that this is the cause of it, and this is what it's driving the president's supporters to try to put this proposal together. There are two answers to this. One is that there, after all, is a reason why all of this has happened over time, and the reason why we've created expertise in the bureaucracy, that the president would have been, in many ways, better advised to pay more attention to the experts on COVID and on a host of other things, because the nation's response would have been far more effective if we had. So there's that piece. The other is that one of the worst mistakes a president could make is simply to try to press ahead with what he or she might want to do without paying attention to at least what the potential downsides might be. One of the things that is one of the greatest contributions of experts in government is not only telling you how to do what you want to do, but what the risks are of pushing too hard along that road as well. And there's an old joke in Washington that if you got a new boss coming in, there are two ways to really do him in. The first is to do nothing of what he says. The other is to do everything of what he says. Because if you do everything, then there's a risk of just driving the truck right off the cliff through mistakes that you didn't anticipate and didn't see coming. So every president is well advised to pay attention to what the experts say. I think experts never really believe that they ought to dictate policy, but they typically believe that there are big mistakes that could be made if, in fact, the president doesn't have a chance to be able to listen to opposing views. And that's why every single major defense operation always has a red team analysis to say what could possibly go wrong so that the president has a chance to be making a fully informed decision.
In our last minute and a half or so, Don, can you talk about the process now? The president signed this order, the period for agencies to review the positions under the order, see which ones go under it and not, ends one day before inauguration.
Yeah, just a coincidence, I am sure. What's happening for sure is that the president wants to try to push this through as quickly as he can. The plan is to try to get this created and, if possible, to sweep as many federal employees into this new system before inauguration day. If the president's reelected, it's a sign of what it is that a second Trump term could look like. If, on the other hand, Biden wins, then it creates a lot of administrative mischief and administrative problems that will have to be untangled. At the very least, it signals a long and ongoing battle over the nature of the federal workforce that's going to be going on for a very long time, regardless of who wins. So this is, even if in fact Biden wins, this is a battle that by no means is over.
And briefly, these civil service protections came originally, I think, from Congress and a law signed by a president, maybe Chester Arthur, I don't know. Could Congress step in and say, no, this is not how it's supposed to work?
I mean, Congress could step in. The difficulty is always is getting Congress to agree on much of anything these days. And so that's an enormous complication in trying to reverse this. But the other piece that's really important to pay attention to here is that the president is asserting his power to be able to overturn not only some of the details of congressional legislation, but also existing regulations through executive order. So in doing this, he's dramatically changing the balance of power between the legislative and the executive branches. And that, apart from everything else, is a very, very big deal that will have long implications going into the future.
Don, thanks a lot for joining us again.
So good to be with you, Rob.
That's Don Kettle, professor of public policy and management at the University of Texas, Austin. He talked with us about President Trump's executive order that could take away job protections from thousands of workers in the federal civil service. More than 7 months into the pandemic, public health experts have made huge strides in understanding how to limit the spread of COVID-19. A lot of it, simple. Wear a mask, keep your distance, wash your hands. But many Wisconsinites are ignoring this guidance, causing hospitalizations and deaths to surge. As Bram Sable-Smith explains, a key ingredient missing from the pandemic response is consistent messaging from government leaders.
Harper Martin knew her dad didn't have many years left, even before he caught the coronavirus. Her dad, Warren Shore, lived with Alzheimer's for a decade. He went into hospice care in March, one day before a safer at home order was issued in Wisconsin. Still, Martin was not expecting to lose him so suddenly.
My dad was waiting for his train, and a bus came sooner.
On July 10th, she went to the memory care facility where he lived in Racine and visited him for the first time since March. She wore a mask, gown, gloves, face shield, and booties for their final 30 minutes together.
I held his hand and I sang to him and I told him that I loved him.
He died the next day, 5 days after testing positive for COVID-19. The former minor league baseball pitcher, journalist, and author is among the more than 1,800 Wisconsinites who have died from the virus.
I just hate that he and so many other people's parents have been added to such an anonymous list.
Public health experts agree on how to prevent infections. It's a playbook that's existed for over 100 years. In fact, back in 1918, Wisconsin was the only state to adopt uniform shutdown measures to fight the misnamed Spanish flu pandemic. Historians credit those moves with limiting deaths. UW epidemiologist Ajay Sethi says a similar model could be effective right now.
You can stop COVID spread with enough PPE and enough precautions and enough buy-in from everybody.
But the state's response to COVID-19 does not have buy-in from everybody. Instead, the tools that public health experts know are effective have become mired in partisan politics. Dominique Brossard is chair of the Department of Life Sciences Communication at UW-Madison.
Unfortunately, we're having a pandemic, election year, in a swing state.
The Republican-controlled legislature successfully sued to end Safer at Home and pushed back against Evers' subsequent orders, a mask mandate and indoor capacity limits. They claim Evers has overstepped his authority, but have offered no plans of their own to slow the virus. Meanwhile, some state Republicans continue to flout the mask mandate at meetings and rallies, some of them indoors, where the virus is more likely to spread. Broussard says all that dueling messaging and legal whiplash
increased the confusion about what was the best thing to do.
Wisconsinites are living and dying with the consequences. The state ranks third in coronavirus infections per capita and ninth in per capita deaths. Similar spikes have prompted even reluctant governors to take action in states like Florida, Arizona, and Texas, where mask mandates and bar closures helped cases fall. But public health experts worry it will take more deaths in Wisconsin before the state leaders unite on a plan. And the failure to control the virus is leaving more families to grieve people like Dwayne Bark. A popular school superintendent, mentor, and former football coach, Bark battled COVID-19 for 3 months in a hospital in Fond du Lac. His oldest son, Bradley, said it was surreal.
This is our hero. This is our mentor. This is our coach. This is our dad that is laying in there with a tube down his throat just to help him breathe.
The family suspects a friend brought the virus into their home during a maskless visit. Four members of the house were hospitalized, but only Dwayne succumbed in October, surrounded by his family. They gathered carefully at a funeral home to pay their last respects and planned to hold a larger celebration of Dwayne's life on his July birthday, assuming group gatherings are once again safe. Bram Sablesmith, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This story comes from a partnership between Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Watch. Coming up, there's more evidence that water exists on parts of the moon's surface. We'll look at what that means for the future of lunar exploration. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to The Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, as local newspapers shut down, a nationwide network of pay-for-play news sites funded by political operatives are taking their place. We'll find out how they operate and what they've been doing, including here in Wisconsin. Now, scientists have known over the past quarter century or so that there's some water on the moon. This week, it came out that there's maybe more up there than we thought. In a paper published in the journal Nature Astronomy, scientists said they found traces of water in this one crater using a NASA aircraft. The big thing, it's in a sunny spot, not in the polar areas where it's darker and colder. That's where ice has been found in previous years. So what does the new discovery mean? How could it affect plans to explore the lunar surface someday? Jeff Faust is a senior staff writer at Space News. He writes about space policy, commercial space, and related topics. Jeff, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be on the show. Thank you.
Jeff, there was some water or ice water on the moon. How big a deal is this new discovery, though?
Well, this is an interesting discovery because they didn't expect to see ice where they found it in this crater called Clavius. And the reason for that is that it's in the sun, and the sun is on the moon and that part of the moon for 2 weeks out of every month. So it gets very hot. The water should evaporate, but they still see it. And so that's a little bit surprising.
Does it give us indications of how much water could potentially be on the moon, whether it's on the surface or below?
Yeah, the water they detected there, it's only in trace amounts. If you took about a cubic yard of lunar soil, there'd be about enough water for at most a 12-ounce bottle of water. So there's not a lot of water, and it's not clear how easy it would be for any future astronauts to extract that water from the soil. But it is a potential resource for any sort of future missions there.
Right. As I understand it, this water, not only is it, there's not a lot of it, it's in little bubbles of glass, in effect. Do I have that right?
Yeah, it's in basically these glass beads that get created when meteorites hit the moon. And so it melts it, you create these little glass beads, and trapped inside the glass beads is water. So you'd have to actually melt those glass beads again to get the water out. You might imagine that would be a bit of a challenge.
Is there any notion, you know, previously we thought, okay, if we want to do anything on the moon, if we want water there, and we would, if we want humans there, we'd have to pack it in with us, whether it's, you know, spread out like this or on those polar areas where we have more ice. Is there a thought that there's actually enough to do to make a difference?
Yeah, the big advantage of using the water that's on the moon is that you don't have to bring it with you. And water tends to be fairly heavy, and that tends to be very expensive to get to the moon. So any sort of resources you can use on the moon will save you a lot of weight and a lot of money to get there. And the polar regions are of particular interest because it looks like there may be large ice deposits in some of those craters, particularly at the south pole of the moon. And NASA has a number of robotic missions coming up to actually go to those regions and basically do prospecting, do some drilling into the lunar soil in those regions, see what form that water ice is in, how much of it is there, and how easy it would be to extract for any sort of future human missions there.
Jeff, there are a lot of different possible space missions for NASA and other national governments and private groups, things like that. Where does the concept of putting humans back on the moon stand on people's priority list right now?
It's really a top priority for NASA right now. NASA has the goal of returning humans to the moon in 4 years, by the end of 2024. And they're working on the various aspects of that program, the rockets, the spacecraft, the landers that would carry astronauts down to the surface to make that possible. It's a challenge. You know, you have all sorts of technical issues. You also have budget issues to make that possible. But the agency is pretty confident that if they can overcome those technical challenges and if Congress comes through with the funding, you could have astronauts there, say, at the South Pole of the moon in about 4 years.
Apart from the symbolic value, how much more do we get out of having astronauts presumably doing research on the surface of the moon as opposed to sending more drones and probes?
Yeah, I mean, robots can do a lot of great science, but humans are a lot more capable than even the best robots that we have today. They also tend to be a little bit more creative. When a robot runs into a problem, you have ground controllers spending days or weeks trying to fix it. You know, an astronaut can take care of it in a very short period of time. So there's a lot of advantages of having people there. It's just sort of a cost-benefit analysis. Is the benefit worth the additional cost of sending astronauts there? And you know, NASA has argued that is the case, and that's the approach that they're taking right now.
Now, water does a lot of stuff for us humans, but also for the geology of Earth or the lunology, I guess, of the moon. I don't know. How much of a thought is there that there's enough water that, you know, it affected the life course of the moon, the rocks and the stratification and the chemistry and things like that?
Yeah, we really need to go there and see what form that water is in and how it has interacted with the rocks and soil to see if it has had any sort of geologic impact. We don't think right now that it has sort of the same sort of effect we've seen on the Earth, where water has, you know, created canyons and, you know, created sedimentary rocks and things like that. We don't think that's the case on the moon, but we won't know for certain until we get there. You know, and one of the things that we've learned from decades of space exploration is that we tend to be surprised. Any sort of place we go, we tend to find things that we did not expect.
Well, hey, closer to Earth, the Halloween coming up, and we're going to have a fairly rare full moon hitting the country in plain view, and it's a blue moon. So it's a good opportunity. We won't see the water from here, but it's a good shot at seeing a full moon.
Yeah, it's a blue moon. Of course, a blue moon is just the second full moon in a month. About every couple of years or so, we have a month where we have two full moons. The second one's called the blue moon, and this year it happens to be in Halloween, and it will be the last blue moon in Halloween for a couple of decades. So it's always a good time to take a look at the moon, but Halloween will be a especially good chance to do so.
And that makes me think, Jeff, this crater that they spotted this trace amount of water in, is this something that somebody with, I don't know, a home, you know, hobby telescope, could they spot that crater? Again, they won't see the water from here, I assume, but could they spot the crater that NASA identified here?
Yeah, they won't see the water, but they can see the crater Clavius. It's a particularly large crater on the moon. So anyone with even a small telescope or a good set of binoculars, you know, should be able to see it, particularly on a full moon like we'll have on Halloween.
That's cool. Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Jeff Faust, a senior staff writer at Space News. We talked to him about new research that confirmed evidence of more water and ice on the surface of the moon. maybe more than we thought, and in places we didn't expect to find it. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Carl Christensen with a story about having the gift of seeing spirits.
Everyone likes a good ghost story, especially around this time of year. Dorothy Malone of Milwaukee shared a childhood encounter with the supernatural at X-Fabula's Story Slam Identity event held in March of 2020.
I was a little girl, and I was able to see ghosts. I could see them all the time, everywhere. Someone told me that if you throw salt over your shoulders, that would get rid of them. So I got every box of Morton salt I can find and just tossing them. Now I'm going down this dark picture, a dark hallway. I see a white shadowy figure. So now I'm cursing, not again. You know, and I'm like, oh my God. So I'm trembling at about 10 years old. And I have heard that they cannot hurt you. You only can hurt yourself. Oh, that was... I'm running in the walls, falling down the stairs, you know, outside at 3 o'clock in the morning. So as time went on, I heard that poltergeists will leave children by the time they're 13 years old. So I can't wait till I'm 13. I just can't wait. I mean, hurry up, you know, because all this time these ghosts are effing with me. So someone said, oh, if you curse them out, then they'll leave. So now I'm having a field day. Leave me to hell. My mother said, whoa, what's going on in there? So that didn't last too long because I got spanked. You know, I got whipped. You know, I'll be using that mouthwash, ivory soap, and all of that. But I'm thinking this would have the ghost leave me alone. Now, here I am at 13. No ghosts. I'm like, oh my God, they're gone, only to have one hovering above my bed. Now, I get the blanket, throw it over it, and give me the look, go somewhere, I don't want to see you no more. It was howling too while it was up, but then I was doing all I beat this shit out of. But I learned I have a gift, and part of my identity is that I could... in black terms, read people. I can tell a little bit about your spirit by talking to you. I can tell, you know, you can't play a player, so I know if you're trying to play me, then I can tell that. You know, and I just have a way with babies. They would just look at me and like, that's a good person. That's the good one right there. And the little kids be like, a compliment all the time. I like your glasses. I like your wig. I'm like, thank you. going through that experience and always trying to find a meaning in life or why I'm here, or looking to the cosmos for my existence, I think that had a part in it growing up. With these ghostly images all around me. But today, you know, I'm at peace with them. I don't fear them as much. And that's my story.
Dorothy Malone's story comes to us from X-Fabula, a storytelling organization based in Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed, wherever you get your podcasts. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
Coming up, we'll find out how a network of news sites funded by political groups is stepping into the vacuum left by closing local newspapers in communities around the country, including here in Wisconsin. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, science fiction has long imagined new worlds and bright futures, but a wave of native writers is turning the genre on its head. From horror to high fantasy, their new tales grapple with past injustice and embrace stories from their ancestors. You'll hear from native authors today at 6 on 1A+. Now, thousands of local newspapers have shut down over the last decade. In many places, the void they've left has been filled by a network of what appear to be traditional local news sites, but are actually pay-for-play operations funded by things like political campaigns and business people. That's according to an investigation from the New York Times, which found examples of these sites in all 50 states, plus plans to drastically expand their operations in the near future. Davey Alba is a technology reporter covering online disinformation and its global effects for the New York Times. Davey, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you investigated this nationwide network of online news sites that look like, you know, a traditional local news outlet, but they're different. What kind of things might people be surprised to learn?
Yeah. So I want to note that this isn't just any kind of local news network of websites. There are actually 1,300 of them, or 1,300, that's right. And that's an enormous scale. You know, the local news chain that we know of that has the highest number of outlets is Gannett, and that's 600 outlets. So this is 1,300 websites, and it's covering the entire U.S. in all 50 states. And what makes it different is that we have uncovered through many months of investigation that this network is actually a pay-to-play network. So we've traced public documentation of candidates, mostly Republican candidates, who have paid for this operation to exist, you know, provided funding, and seen also on the back end of the articles that are published on these sites that they are ordered up by Republican operatives and corporate PR firms. So this is essentially a propaganda network, and that is what is very different from a regular local news site, regular local news network, and what we found here.
Now, if somebody is reading one of these things in their hometown, let's just call it Hometown Wisconsin, and they might see a thing called the Hometown Gazette or something, what does it look like to them? Do they see an indication that this is a paid site with a particular leaning?
Absolutely not. In fact, if you go into the about pages of many of these sites, the sites actually go out of their way to say that they are unbiased and, you know, very fair in their coverage. But at the same time that they have these notices on their website, we have seen internal emails that show that, you know, assigning editors would email the freelance writers that they have employed and say that they should not focus any of their articles on a Democratic lawmaker or a Democratic bill because their clients are conservative. So, you know, when you go to one of these sites, you'll see that they're blanketed with a lot of political coverage, and spend any amount of time on them, any significant amount of time on them, and you'll see that most of the coverage is very positive towards Republicans and very negative towards Democrats, if there is coverage of Democrats at all.
You talked to some of the freelance journalists who had been paid to write for some of these sites. What did they say about how this worked and how they were utilized as journalists?
They did not have a full picture of what was even going on. So to them, they were employed as freelancers doing local news assignments for newspapers all around the country. And they were, you know, doing the job of a local news journalist. And the thing that's obscured to them is that the clients were actually ordering up these articles, and in many cases that we've seen, writing very detailed instructions about who to interview and, you know, what questions to ask. They don't know that those clients are actually conservative operatives in a lot of cases. And you know, we've spoken to writers who actually started turning down assignments because they caught wind that it felt so one-sided. But, you know, on the whole, they think they're just local news reporters. It's a much more nefarious thing in reality than they're led to believe.
Talking to Davey Alba, technology reporter at the New York Times, about a web of what appear to be local news websites, filling gaps in many cases left by the absence of local news outlets, including Wisconsin. I think there were 24 here in the state. One example was stories related to the Jacob Blake shooting and the aftermath of that from what appeared to be a local Kenosha site. What did we see there?
Yeah, if you actually go to KenoshaReporter.com, you'll see examples of how this all works. A lot of these sites tend to just be seated and then lie in wait until something local happens and it's a hot button issue. And then they fire up and they publish articles with a certain slant. So you'll see on KenoshaReporter.com that the website has published articles that are critical of Jacob Blake, the unarmed Black man who was shot by a police officer, and talking about his criminality and how protesters, you know, protesting his shooting are criminal. At the same time, these websites are pushing themselves to be objective and fair. So it's a real problem. It's a real problem, especially because local news is on the decline. We've spoken to experts who have said that 2,100 papers, most of them local newspapers, have shut down in the past decade or so. And what's filling in for them are these very partisan news sites that is rushing in. And in a lot of cases, the motives of these sites are not clearly disclosed. So that's a very troubling thing. It should concern all of us.
And you went looking for equivalent sites on the left or liberal sites. You found some. What did you see when it came to the scale?
We found some. There's the Courier News Network, which is backed by a liberal PAC. And some other examples, both on the right and the left. But the thing that stands out about this network is that it is huge. I can't overstate that enough. It's 1,300 websites. Most of the other networks that we found are a handful, so sometimes in the dozens of sites. And this website, this network of websites, really stands out for its scope and its ambitions and what it hopes to be. The founder the person who's in charge of the websites, essentially running all of them, is a man named Brian Timponi, who is from Illinois. And he has stated in other interviews, he never talked to us, but he stated in other interviews that he plans to roll out 15,000 more websites in the next few months, the next year or so. 34 that started in Illinois to years later, 1,300 to 15,000. That is something that really can't be glossed over. It's an important issue.
Davey, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Davey Alba is a technology reporter covering online disinformation and its global effects for the New York Times. She talked with us about her investigation into a network of pay-for-play news sites that are taking the place of local newspapers around the country here in Wisconsin. You can find a link to the investigation she worked on at WPR.org/Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 8, voting has been going on in Wisconsin for weeks, and polling has been going on for months in this year's presidential election. Kate welcomes Wisconsin pollsters for a look at the picture in the closing days of the race and how pollsters are trying to get things as right as possible. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Up next is news from NPR and from Wisconsin Public Radio. Then it's the week in Washington, where a White House reporter joins us to talk about several top national political stories, including why Democrats think Georgia could be in play for Joe Biden. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.